Support for the Splendid Table podcast provided by the Muir Glen Organic Soup Collection. Gourmet recipe soups made from premium garden fresh ingredients. Online at muirglen.com.
It's Lynn Rossetto Casper with the Splendid Table. Well, today it's the woman who brought America roast garlic, cassoulet, and confit of everything. Our guest is Paula Wolfert. She talks about where it all started some 20 years ago. It was with her then groundbreaking book, The Cooking of Southwest France, and she talks why she's updated the book now. Well, the Stearns have found a museum of taxidermy and great breakfasts in Graybull, Wyoming. Peter Mayle is back in Provence with Confessions of a French Baker. We go to Portland, Oregon's Restaurant of the Year. It's called Andina, it's upscale Peruvian, and a new concept for America. And we have another side of the Portland food scene, the oil wars. All this and your calls coming up on the Splendid Table. But first, this. It's Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. Our program is produced by American Public Media and brought to you by SuperTarget. Well, today it is she of the lusty recipes and unrelenting scholarship. Our guest is Paula Wolfert. Now, she's just updated her groundbreaking classic, The Cooking of Southwest France. Now, 20 years ago, this book introduced us to a part of France even the French ignored, and no restaurant menu has been the same since. The ever-curious Peter Mayle of A Year in Provence fame is back to talk the secrets of the village baker. We go to Portland to get the story behind its restaurant of the year. It's called Andina, it's Peruvian, and it has a cultural mission. Then it's why Portland drivers are stealthily pulling up to restaurant back doors in the wee hours. And as always, in the second half of the show, we're going to be opening the lines for your calls. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. So let's roll with Jane and Michael Stern. They write the Road Food column in Gourmet magazine. Hey, Jane, Michael, you guys have been out west.
Oh, we have been rooting and tooting all over Wyoming and Montana. And just when we go out there yet again, we always think, well, you know, in this fairly unoccupied corner of the world, how can we find anything new and wonderful? Well, we did in Graybull, Wyoming, which is just such a wonderful name for a town.
Where is Graybull?
Well, if you head west out of Sheridan, you know, you go through the Bighorn Mountains, which are just a spectacle unto themselves. And as you come down west of the Bighorns, the town of Graybull is right there. It's a tiny town. It's got a few odd and interesting attractions other than Lisa's restaurant, which we'll tell you about later. Some of these attractions are the Museum of Flight and Aerial Firefighting. This is one of the most amazing museums I have ever seen, because what it is a gigantic airfield with all kinds of old airplanes that they used to use to fight fires in the mountains.
And there's also in Graybull is an awesome museum of taxidermy. So after you've seen the firefighting equipment, you can see a lot of dead stuffed animals. And then go shopping at Probst's Western Ware Shop, which has been there since the 1940s. And I swear our salesman had been there since the 1940s.
Yes. But those places are great. Those places are fabulous.
Wonderful.
But the main reason for going to Graybull is to eat at a restaurant called Lisa's. What I love about them is their motto on the menu is they call this restaurant a tribute to the original cowboy camp cook and the Native American way of cooking on our Western plains.
Which makes it seem like it would be kind of a, I don't know, if I heard that, I would think it was sort of like a yuppie endeavor, but in fact, it's just a very simple lunchroom with great food and a lot of care taken in what they put on the plate.
And as a side dish for many meals, you get a nice wonderful tile of crisp fried Indian fry bread. Mm. You know that stuff? It's sort of like a sopapilla.
Yeah,
that
yeah.
Puffy bread that just like kind of puffs up in the kettle. We had breakfast there. That was what wowed us. We had just this amazingly good corned beef hash. Now, I'm an aficionado of corned beef hash. This was like really chunky, spicy corned beef hash with like beef that kind of just shredded as you touched it with a fork. And it was like really kind of, I don't know how to, it was, I don't want to say it was dry, but it was so unfatty. It was just like the flavor of corned beef.
It was more beef than potatoes. I had a cool thing also. I had the breakfast charlotta, which is, okay, a tortilla stuffed with potato hash and eggs, pork chile, polenta.
I love it. I'm yours.
Kind
I'm yours.
Of wonderful, you know, mishmash.
Right.
But it, you know, you eat one breakfast charlotta and you know, you don't have to eat for the rest of the day.
Well, I'm going to tell on Jane because on the side of her breakfast charlotta, she had biscuits and sausage gravy too. And those were really, really good.
Girl after my own heart,
I helped
Jane.
Her eat those.
But I had the sausage gravy on the side. I was very dietetic.
Hey, guys. Thank you.
And a 97-ounce Coca-Cola with it. My usual breakfast drink.
Thanks for taking us to Grable.
Okay, Lynn.
Bye, Lynn.
Bye.
Stick shifts and safety belts. Bucket seats have all got to go when we're driving. In the car, it makes my baby seem so far. I need you here with me.
Jane and Michael Stern are the authors of Two for the Road. Now, you can join the Sterns here every week, or you can find their food finds anytime on the website, you know, splendidtable.org. And while you're visiting the website, be sure to check out our new online space at gathered.com. Now, we've started the Splendid Table Food Talk group. It's another opportunity for you to get your questions answered, trade recipes, and meet like minds. So head to splendidtable.org and click on Food Talk. Back, Englishman Peter Mayle made the big break. He went after the dream. He ditched a high-powered life in London for a quiet, peaceful life in Provence, you know, the south of France. Well, over his first year there, he scribbled a little diary. He called it A Year in Provence. Well, a gazillion sales later, Peter is still chronicling life in France. He's taken on the garagiste winemakers, food festivals, and now it's the village baker. Peter Mayle's latest book, written with baker Gerard Ozé, is Confessions of a French Baker, Bread-Making Secrets, Tips, and Recipes. Peter, it's good to have you back.
Thank you very much, Lynn. Nice to be here.
So, Peter, you know, I'm just thinking, you've got supermarkets in France, working couples, people aren't cooking the way they used to, and nobody has time really to shop the way they used to. So does the village baker still stand a chance?
Oh, very much so, yeah. I mean, I live a couple of kilometers from a village of 1,000, perhaps 1,000 inhabitants. There are two bakers in the village, both of whom have their fans and both of whom do very good business. So that is not by any means exceptional down in the country. Also, mm-hmm. You know, you go up to Paris and there's a very, very famous baker's there called Poilane.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a queue outside his store every day. And that's in Paris where the choice and the variety are all over the place. So I think the French tend to look on bread not perhaps as we Anglo-Saxons do, just as a commodity and something to put the peanut butter on, but as a separate food. And it's got a lot of tradition behind it. And I think it's going to stay. I don't think it's going to go away.
Wasn't, though, the classic baguette the most identified type of French bread? Wasn't that deeply threatened at one point?
It was indeed, because the villainous supermarkets, they decided that this was some time ago. They decided that they would produce a machine-made loaf and call it the one-franc baguette. And, of course, the difference between their bread and baker's bread is that the baker makes his baguettes by hand, and they taste a lot better, too. Anyway, the bakers were up in arms, and, in fact, Gérard Osé's father, Roger, was one of the instigators of a trip he made up to Paris with a group of bakers, and it's one of the very, very few occasions in French history where a group of Frenchmen have actually thought the same way about anything. And they went up to Paris and they besieged the Minister of Dough, or whatever he was called, and said, you know, this is scandalous and you're trying to destroy the fabric of French life, and we artisan bakers want some recognition, some official recognition. So they worked out this thing which is called the Bannette, which is really a little more than a logo, but... Uh-huh. If you find that over the on a baker's store, it is a guarantee of the fact that he will make traditional bread by hand the way it ought to be made. And if he doesn't have that sign, she should be treated with deep suspicion.
So this is what you have to always look for over the door of every bakery that you think you might want to step into.
Right.
You know, typically French. You know what? We laugh, but this is the kind of thing that keeps the quality of a food alive. And when you think
Absolutely.
About this, that you have a march on the Capitol to save
sure.
a loaf of bread.
Oh, God, and there was probably all sorts of threatened violence and pelting with stale buns and things like that. I don't
exactly.
know, but I mean,
exactly. Well, with all this, how hard was it to pick a baker to focus on for this book?
Well, it was, in fact, not me who picked him, but him who picked me, because I went to his bakery some 15 years ago, I suppose, before, well, he appeared in A Year in Provence briefly, because I thought it was a wonderful bakery. And we've been friends ever since. And he now gives little basic baking courses in the back of his shop, where the bread is made every week, to visitors, because he's had a few tourists come by in his time.
Mm-hmm.
And he said to me one day, he said, you know, I'm getting more and more of these people, and they're very nice, but I'd like to give them something to go away with, you know, a little souvenir, a memento. So I said, yeah, that's a nice idea. And he said, and what I thought would be nice was recipes. I'm going to do 14 different recipes for 14 different breads. And then what I'd like is a little bit of history and a few anecdotes and, you know, to sort of make it into a little book. And I said, what a nice idea, Gérard. And he said, yeah. And then there was a silence, and I began to realize that we were not here by accident in the corner of the bakery. And he said, and you're the only writer I know, so you can write it. And so I did.
As he stuffed you with croissants.
Oh, right? Yeah. No, he bribed me endlessly and shamelessly. But he's a great guy. He's the fourth generation to bake in his family in the same part of the world. And he does it just the way his dad used to do it. And he makes 1,000 pieces of bread a day. And he has people coming into his shop sometimes twice a day for the morning baguette and for the evening baguette, because, as he says, it's got a shelf life of approximately 4 hours.
Uh-huh.
So you need to eat it fresh, and the French do, and then they come back for more. It never goes in the fridge, for instance.
What an incredible country that buys its bread by the hour.
Yeah,
fascinating.
It's pretty good, isn't it?
Peter, thank you.
It's a great pleasure.
Peter Mayle is co-author with baker Gérard Osé of Confessions of a French Baker. Coming up, feasting in Southwest France with Paula Wolford and the Peruvian restaurant that's taken Portland, Oregon. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show about life's appetites. Our show is brought to you by Super Target, home of Archer Farms, where you can find modern takes on old-time classics like angel food cake, quiche, and garlic bread. Find them online at target.com/supertarget. When you see on a menu roasted garlic, potatoes crisped in duck fat, or that overused term confit, you gotta know that this is all because of one woman, a groundbreaker. The leader of the pack of the food writer as scholar. Now, I am talking about Paula Wolford, Nobody I know digs into how a dish sings and speaks of its place of origin the way Paula does. Well, back in 1983, Paula came out with the book that started this collection of trends. I mean, this is the stuff that we now think of as normal restaurant eating. The book was called The Cooking of Southwest France, and in it she brought us food that we had never heard of. Well, after 20 years, Paul has completely updated the classic. There is a new book called The Cooking of Southwest France, Recipes from France's Magnificent Rustic Cuisine. Hey, Paula, good to have you back.
Oh, it's so great to hear your voice, Lynn. Thank you.
Well, tell me, what was it like? I mean, I know these books are like babies, and what was it like sort of looking again? I mean, you were rebirthing the child. What was that like for you?
Well, at first, I thought I was just going to do the late, you know, in other words, some of the chefs that I had worked with and some of the cooks that I knew had retired or passed away. Mm-hmm. And I thought I was just going to update it. And then all of a sudden, I looked around and I said, my God, I wrote this book before there was verjus in this country, before there was moutarde violette, before there was foie gras, before there was all the different ingredients that make Southwest food alive. What was I doing before? And so I realized I had to update the book. And in doing so, I made some of the recipes a lot easier because I didn't have to squeeze out the flavor. The flavor just came in a bottle, like truffle oil.
But I think we need a little geography, though, for most of us. What area are we actually talking about?
The corridor between Toulouse and Bordeaux, if you wanted to do a straight line across, and then everything above it and below it that would make one quarter of France. I extended the Southwest to accommodate getting more Atlantic seafood into my book. I mean, otherwise the book was just a little too much duck fat to the 10th degree.
Yeah, this is the land of duck fat. So essentially it's the part that borders Spain and
yes.
part of the, and it's west of the Rhone River, right?
Right, exactly. And I don't touch the Rhone, but I do ooze up a little bit into the Auvergne because wherever there is confit and duck fat, there's the Southwest.
But give us an example, though, a sense of the food of this part of the world.
Well, I mean, there's wonderful chicken cooked with garlic pearls. In other words, the garlic cooked in its own little skins and then served with a sauterne wine sauce. But we can use our California sweet wine. Mm-hmm. That's a wonderful, wonderful recipe. And there's a wonderful... Do you have ramps up around where you are?
We get them in the spring, yeah. Yeah, they're wild leeks, and they're strong, and they're delicious, and I'm seeing
right.
them more and more around the country.
Okay,
yeah.
Well, when I went back to Southwest France, I discovered they have ramps in Southwest France. They call them poireaux de vigne, the leeks of the vineyards, wild leeks. And they make a wild leek and mushroom tart that is so divine. And I've tried it with American ramps, and it's fabulous. So there's a lot of things that I discovered going a second time around.
And this is also, this is the land of cassoulet, because I remember when you were putting this book together and you did all these articles in magazines and you did a treatise on cassoulet.
It's
that
in the
had,
book.
Yeah, that was, I remember reading it and saying, my life has now changed. But the thing I think of most as being part of Southwest France is this idea of the confit. And do you think you could kind of briefly walk us through what a confit is and how to make it?
Okay, the word preserve, that's where the word confit comes from.
Ah.
That means you're putting up something. And most confit in France is either made with duck or pork, or even pork rind, mm-hmm. and goose as well. But not we don't use that so much here in the States. And the duck or the goose or the pork are seasoned with salt and herbs overnight. And then that draws out the excess moisture in the meat, which would harm it in the preserving stage, which will be later on. It's then cooked in its own fat or a mixture of pork and duck fat or a mixture mm-hmm. of pork and goose fat and duck fat, not chicken fat, and even a little oil if you don't have enough fat. And you cook it very, very slowly until you can actually see the skin move away from the bone. You then let it cool down, and then you pack it. Now,
so you're packing it in its own fat, so it's completely covered in the fat.
Yes. Now, when you go to a restaurant, you're usually getting 1, 2, or 3-day-old confit because they don't have the room to store it. But if you were to make it at home, you should really think about making it now for Christmas. I'm not kidding. It'll be so delicious because it gets a husky, ripened flavor. You know, Alice Waters, the famous Alice Waters, was over my house, and we had a confit tasting about 6 months ago because I wanted to try out different ideas with her. Mm-hmm. And one of the confits was one that was about 2 days old, and everybody was raving about it because I had cooked it in a plastic satchel, you know, the sous vide method, which is what all the chefs are doing today. And one of the people there, I'm not going to say her name, she says, oh, this is fabulous. It's so moist. It's so gooey. I love it. And Alice said something, which is so typically Alice. It has no chi.
Energy. As in Chinese energy flow.
Then she turned to this person. She said, taste Paula's 5-month-old duck confit. Huh. Well, side by side, it was a revelation. I had never really done that before. Nothing wrong with the 2-day confit. It was still delicious. And when I make it for cassoulet, because you're going to have to then cook the confit a second time in the beans for hours and hours, actually, you might as well make the 2-day confit. What's the point? I mean,
But if you're serving it on its own.
If you're serving it on its own, God, you want it to have a little bit of age. I mean, we're at a certain age. We know how good we are.
On that note, Paula, many thanks.
Well, thank you.
Thanks, darling. Paula Wolford is the author of the newly updated The Cooking of Southwest France. Now, you have got to try Paula's recipe for chicken breasts in garlic wine. It's simple, and there's a concoction that you make, garlic and herbs in wine. I'm stashing that one away to use on other dishes. So check out the recipe. It's on the website, splendidtable.org. In 2005, Portland, Oregon's Oregonian newspaper named Andina as their restaurant of the year. Now, considering Portland's a hotbed of the Eat Local New American movements, how did the city's first upscale Peruvian restaurant get this kind of tribute? Well, Andina sits on a corner in the Pearl District. It's in a converted warehouse. It's all windows. It glows from the street. Inside, it's sleek yet comfortable. The place just feels good. We ate our way through dishes that we'd never had before. A dynamite potato lime cake called causa, a seafood stew under a puffed crust of quinoa, and a blue corn drink that I could have sipped every single day. Well, the question in my mind was, who's behind this? What's the thinking here? Well, Doris Platt Rodriguez is a small woman, dark hair. She's the mother of grown sons, but doesn't look it. There's a softness about her, a shyness, but her eyes reflect a very busy mind. Everything about her says that this place is not just a business. We talked to Doris as lunch was being prepped in the kitchen behind us. Doris, what does the name Andina mean?
Andina is related to the Andes. And reflect the range, high mountains that goes from north to south. And believe me, shape the geography of Peru, shape our lives, shape our personality, and also the Andes become the soul, the bread and basket of our food in Peru.
Doris, when we came here for dinner last night, I have to be honest, I was totally unprepared for what I walked into. I expected a place that was going to feel exactly like an old building in Peru. But this is a loft space. The colors are blues and oranges and sun yellows, but it's very modern and contemporary, warm lighting. And then there's also a face to this menu. You have the traditional dishes, and then you have what you call essentially the Nuevo Andina cuisine, which is a very modern take. Tell me how this
How did you design this? What was in your mind when you pulled this together?
Thinking about having our restaurant that reflects Peru, it was a little bit difficult to see in our mind the best we can offer to the public, because we love my country and we wanted to show to the people of United States in the Northwest that we can share art, we can share architecture, we can share all the colors of, so like a rainbow. When you go to Peru, and I really want for you to go to Peru and be able to see with your own eyes the diversity, the contrast, in everything is contrast. Contrast in between poverty and wealth. There's contrast between the coastal zone and the beautiful landscapes in the Andes. Mm-hmm. The architecture is also a variety of architecture. You see beautiful churches from colonial times, but also you see Incas,
the native peoples,
that, and you can see in the trapezoid shapes.
Trapezoids?
Trapezoids, and you know why? The trapezoid shape has a practical reason. Peru is a volcanic region, so it's prone to earthquakes. And I don't know how the Incas knew that the trapezoid shape and tilted the wall a little bit inwards brings some kind of protection against earthquakes.
And I'm looking at the bar, and behind the bar you have trapezoid framing of shelves with displays of pottery.
And you can store there bottles of wine and glasses.
And then you have arches.
We have arches. There's a glimpse of the colonial time.
Doris, could we go into the kitchen? Because I'm seeing piles of green herbs and people are shelling fava beans and they're shucking corn. Could we go in and look?
Of course. Come on, please, follow me.
You're prepping for lunch, from what I can see.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
And pots are boiling and we have chefs working. Everybody's working by hand. There don't seem to be very many machines here.
No.
What, there are these beautiful bright orange chilies on a prep cart.
And you know, one of the ingredients that make Peruvian food different from others is the use of hot peppers we call ajíes. So we have our basic ingredients, a yellow puree of we call ají amarillo or escabeche.
Mm-hmm.
And we use a red pepper we call ají panca. It's dry.
Doris, I want to interrupt you because there's so much going on in this kitchen, but I see your very young chef. Is it Jose Luis?
Jose Luis.
And he's shucking corn. Could we talk to him?
Yes, please. Come. Jose Luis?
Yes.
You shuck corn. What kind of corn are you using?
We're using the small Concornless American corn.
So it's a sweet corn?
Yes.
And is this traditional in Peru to use sweet corn?
Yes.
I always thought it would have been, you know, like a corn that is not sweet.
No, actually, the Concornless is bigger.
But it's
the same sweetness. I think it's even less sweet than this one.
Now, you've come here from Peru. Where are you from in Peru?
I live in Lima, the capital.
I'm curious to know, we have a traditional side of the menu here, and then you've got a very contemporary side.
Yes.
What influences that? Is it what's happening here in America, or is it what's happening in Peru?
No, it's what's happening in the best restaurants in Peru right now, you know? For example, French bases and Asian bases, and they mix together Peruvian ajíes, you know, the chilies.
Yes.
And the stocks we made with these French and Asian bases.
Fusion,
no?
But is this something new for
Peruvians? It's something new, yes.
It's something new for Peruvian
Even
chefs.
For Peruvians, yes.
There's a dish on the traditional side of the menu I have to ask you both about, because when I saw it and saw the description, I couldn't understand. It's called, I think, lomo or lumbo. It's called lumbo saltato?
Yeah, lomo saltato.
Lomo saltato. And it says it's beef tenderloin that is stir-fried in a wok with the seasonings and with soy sauce.
Yes.
Now, is this just Chinese or Asian influence from now, or is it, I mean, is this traditional? Because it's on the traditional side of the menu.
Actually, you know, in Peru, we have like so many immigrants from Chinese people. We have also Italians. We have also, for example, black people living in Peru. So if you travel to Peru small towns, you can taste different things, you know, different techniques.
And it's all here on the menu. That's the thing that's so exciting.
Yeah, it is.
Doris Platt Rodriguez, thank you so much.
Oh, you are very welcome. Thank you.
Doris Platt Rodriguez and her family created and run Restaurant Andina in Portland, Oregon. Now, to get the recipe for that blue corn drink called Chicha Morada, check out the website, splendidtable.org. It's time for your calls, brought to you by Muir Glen Organic Soups, created to savor. Now you can reach us at 800-537-5252. Okay, let's get to the phones. We have got Peter calling from Fort Lauderdale. Hey, Peter, what do you want to talk about?
Well, I have kind of a two-part question about wine having to do with selecting the best wine for cooking.
Aha, okay. And what's the other part?
Well, as you know, we've been going through a lot of hurricanes down here in South Florida,
I
ended up cleaning out my mother's refrigerator last year, and she had some wine that we covet highly from Michigan, from the St. Julian wineries in Paw Paw, and I wanted to save it, and she said, well, it's probably turned to vinegar, and so I said, well, I'll use it in cooking then, and I used it, and it had such a wonderful, robust flavor that I was wondering if when you're selecting a cooking wine, if you can use any kind of wine, you know, what kind of wine would you select, and then how should you handle it, store it, and then, you know, use it for preparation?
You know, I think this is one of the most often asked questions that we get, and especially because we so often see on the market shelves cooking wine, something labeled cooking wine. If it says cooking wine, you never want to buy it because it's really, it's rot gut with salt in it. It's really bad stuff. You want to cook with something you drink, but that does not mean that it has to be expensive. And you know, your example of the wine that was so delicious. Did you taste it, by the way? Did it taste good, the Michigan wine?
Well, it tasted a little different than it normally does. It's a rosé. It has a very, very good flavor. It still tasted good, but it did seem a little vinegary, and I don't know if that was just
a
perception.
You know, if it's if it's a little bit like that, and you know, you always boil down stuff or cook in wine when you cook with it, so you end up with the essence of the wine, and that extra acidity probably wouldn't do any harm to a lot of the dishes you were doing. I mean, when it's really off and it tastes absolutely foul, you don't want to use it. But some wines to keep around that you would drink and you would cook with that are really reasonable. I would have a dry white, like a Sauvignon Blanc. And you know, it could be $4.99 a bottle. You know, Trader Joe's out on the coast. The Trader Joe's are opening up all over the place. They have something called $2 and $3 Chuck. It's something called Charles Shaw wine. And this stuff is so drinkable, I can't tell you. And it comes in a lot of flavors. You know, the Zinfandel, the Cabernet, I think. And I think there's a white one. But if you find an inexpensive wine you like the taste of, and it's dry, it's not terribly sweet, that's what you cook with. So think a Sauvignon Blanc and think either a Zinfandel, a Merlot, or a Cabernet. Two brands I know of where I live in the middle of the country that are really inexpensive and very respectable. One is Pepperwood, and the other one is very silly. It's called Barefoot, which I think would be perfect for Fort Lauderdale, Florida. Either one of those brands I know, very inexpensive, really respectable wines, and you would not be ashamed to serve them to friends.
Sounds great.
Yeah. So that's your basic rule. Hey, have a good one. Thank you.
You too.
Bye. Well, it's time for this week's trivia challenge. Now, the question is, what's the connection between bird flu and the spice star anise? Well, we're going to have that answer in a moment, and we'll get the story behind the oil wars of Portland. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. The Splendid Table is brought to you by Super Target. It's Target, now available in food, where you can find the expected and unexpected aisle after aisle. Online at target.com/supertarget.
Well, we're going to be taking more of your calls in a moment. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. But first, I've got the answer to this week's trivia challenge. Now, the question was, what's the link between bird flu and the spice star anise? Well, the answer is Tamiflu. We found an article in the Washington Post Foreign Service that intrigued me. It seems Chinese farmers who grow the spice star anise are doubling their incomes this year. Now, traditionally used in stews and five spice seasonings, star anise is a star-shaped little seed pod, and it tastes like licorice. Well, it contains an acid used in the production of Tamiflu. Roche Holding AG, the Swiss pharmaceutical giant, which owns Tamiflu, is upping its production and now has cornered the market on star anise. But before rushing to your local grocery, hear this. To be used in Tamiflu, star anise has to be processed in a very complicated way. So the big message in the article is eating star anise is not going to help us with the flu. Well, let's get back to your calls. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. Okay, let's see. Who has been waiting patiently? Well, this call comes to us through our discussion group at food.gather.com. It's Tom calling from Boston. Tom, what do you want to talk about?
I have a lasagna question for you.
Oh, God, I love lasagna questions. Okay, go for it. Go for it.
Just after I graduated and got my first place, I went home and raided Mom's recipe book. And she had a great lasagna that I used to love as a kid.
Mm-hmm.
And I noticed in the recipe that she had an instruction which was freeze overnight. But I figured it was only if you were going to prep it the day before and then actually serve the lasagna the next day.
Right.
So I went ahead and skipped that step, and I actually just baked the lasagna and served it.
Mm-hmm.
And it came out really runny and didn't hold together when I went to serve it. And so I called my mom, and I asked her, you know, what I'd done wrong. And she said, well, did you freeze it? And I told her I hadn't. And she said, oh, you've got to freeze it. It makes the lasagna much better. And I thought it was kind of amusing that that would make a difference. And I was trying to figure out why it made a difference. And so I thought I'd give you a call and see if you do.
Okay. First thing, for this diagnosis, the doctor is going to need, tell me the kind of lasagna it was. Is it the kind with the tomato sauce and the ricotta cheese and the mozzarella?
Exactly. So we're drizzling layers of ricotta and tomato sauce between layers of noodles. I think it was three layers of each.
Okay.
Pretty tall lasagna.
And the noodles are cooked and then put into the lasagna.
They are indeed, yeah.
Okay.
That's right.
There is a pasta out there that you just layer.
Yeah, I've never used that. I heard of it. Right.
Yeah, and I haven't used it in a long time. Okay, well, putting on my science hat. Why would it not get sloppy if it were frozen?
She goes right from the freezer to the oven, if that's helpful. She doesn't let it defrost.
Right. I think, okay, this is the only thing I can think of, and there may be a scientist out there who's going to say poo and bah, and this is the real reason. But this would be logical, because the two main ingredients in this, the mozzarella and the ricotta, have a lot of moisture in them.
Right.
And these are lasagnas that tend to get very moist when you serve them. But if you've noticed, even if you let the lasagna sit overnight in a refrigerator or for a day or so,
right,
it suddenly gets firm. Now, I think by freezing it, you're accelerating what's happening in the refrigerator. The freezer is an extremely dry environment. That means that some, believe it or not, even overnight, some evaporation takes place in that moisture. Okay, sure. of the cheese. The other thing is that the pasta has a chance to absorb the moisture. And then when you start to cook it frozen, I think the heat finishes it off.
That's great, so it can juice more.
Okay. Yeah, it is the action of the pasta, because the pasta is a sponge. I mean, essentially, that's what pasta does. It absorbs moisture. And it's the factor that the freezer is such a dry environment. And the refrigerator is similar. I think if you put the uncooked lasagna in the refrigerator for 2 days and then you baked it off, you may actually find the same thing happens. But I like your mom's idea. You freeze it overnight. Bing, you're done. Put it in frozen.
Okay, makes a lot of sense. Thank you.
Yeah, and your mom is a brilliant woman. And tell her, for me, thank you, because guess what I'm going to be doing from now on?
I'll let her know. She'll be thrilled.
Okay. Hey, Tom.
Well. Thanks.
Thanks for calling. You take care.
You too.
What a cool idea. And you see, my Italian ancestors would never know that because they didn't have freezers. Call us 800-537-5252. We have got Michael on the phone from Minneapolis. Michael, what's up? What do you want to talk about?
Yes, Lynn, this is Michael from Broder's in Minneapolis.
Oh, Michael's the chef at one of my favorite pasta places, Broder's. Hey, Michael, you have a question for us. What do you want to talk about?
I'd like to talk about farro today. Trying to find a way to use it either in some sort of a dessert or as a sweet accompaniment to cheese. And I'm wondering if you've ever done anything farro in that way.
Yeah. For those of you who aren't familiar with farro, farro is a very ancient form of wheat. It's the other name for it is emmer. And it's shown up all over the country now being imported from Italy. And it has, a little more protein than wheat does, or most wheat does. And it's very nutty, and it has a sweet undertone. And you can use it wherever you might use rice or any other grain. You know, I'm thinking of some traditional ways that it's used, especially in central and southern Italy. For instance, you boil it up and then you serve it warm or cold with ricotta and honey. You know, full fat ricotta, really delicious ricotta.
You know,
one way, and it's very popular right now. It's boiled down grape syrup. You know, when they press grapes in Italy, what they will do is take some of that juice and boil it down, and sometimes with spices, etc., until it's a really rich syrup. And the trick you do here is you can use supermarket grapes, but you boil it down with a bit of sugar and red wine. And then you can throw in a cinnamon stick and some black pepper and some orange rind, because this is kind of southern style, and you get this real syrup. I do it in a big skillet, and then you boil your farro, and then you just fold that syrup into it. And you could use that next to a dish of really great fresh cheeses.
And then would you just let that cool?
I'd serve it at room temperature. But it's just delicious.
Well, that sounds wonderful.
Yeah, it really is. I think that might be a great way to do it.
All right. Well, thank you very much for your information.
You're welcome.
We'll talk to you again.
You take care.
Bye-bye.
They do great pasta there. Call us, 800-537-5252. We have Amy on the line from Bethalto, Illinois. I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly.
Yes, you did.
Good. What do you want to talk about?
I actually had a question about olive oil, and I hear a lot of comments, you know, get a nice fruity olive oil for a salad dressing, get a milder one for your saute work, you know, like a less expensive one for that. And then I also hear people talk about don't let your olive oil go rancid.
Right. Right.
I guess what I'm looking for is guidance on, like, shelf life. And is there a difference in the shelf life between the fruity and the not-so-fruity?
No, there's no difference in the shelf life between the fruity and the not-so-fruity, or the peppery and the almondy, you know, or et cetera.
Okay. And what does a rancid olive oil smell? I mean, is it the
smell? It smells really bad. Foul? It smells... best way to do it is you take a whiff and it smells either... this sounds weird. Oily, but with nothing else, you know, really, or it actually smells offensive.
Ew,
it
okay.
smells maybe a little acidic.
So there's no guesswork once you open it, you're going
to
know.
No, okay. Let's start at the beginning, how to store it. And this is true of any cold-pressed oil. Like, you know the new nut oils that you're starting to see in the... they're pricey, but you're starting to see them in fancy stores.
There are, yeah.
Yeah, they're cold-pressed and they're fragile. The nut oils, they should actually go in the refrigerator. But with olive oil, you want it away from light and you want it away from heat. It doesn't have to be in the fridge, but it should be in a cool, dark place. So that means forget putting it next to the stove.
No, I learned that a long time ago.
Yeah, I'm appalled when I see, you know, kitchen designers saying, and here's where you'll put your oil. It's on the stove hood, you know, and it's a shelf. And I'm thinking, oh, yeah. You can burn your money and, you know, get rid of it faster. The other thing is that sometimes as an oil oxidizes, as it's exposed to light and air, it will turn a deeper color.
Okay.
And it sometimes turns yellow. And if it's a very dark yellow, often it's starting to go. Now, when you're getting into premium olive oils, ones with great flavor, they're extra virgin, and they're very expensive. And these are usually the ones you use for salad dressing or flavoring cooked dishes. Never buy that oil unless there's a date on the bottle, and the date should be the harvest date of the olives, not a date that says best before.
Oh.
But a date that says harvested, or in Italian, raccolto,
okay.
R-A-C-C-O-L-T-O.
T-O, I think.
Okay.
But something that indicates when those olives were harvested, because that's also going to tell you when the olives were pressed.
Okay.
And it should be no more than a year old. Not that it goes rancid after a year, but it loses a lot of character. And if you're paying a lot of money, you want prime olive oil.
Sure, sure.
So, and you should know olives are pressed in the winter. That's the other thing. They're being picked as we speak right now throughout the Mediterranean and being pressed.
I knew I liked winter for some other reason.
Well, yeah, exactly. And you get great oil. So that gives you an idea of the how to store it. And, you know, I mean, they can keep for a couple of years, but if you're spending a great deal of money, you really want something prime. If you're buying a more modest oil, then you want, you know, a couple of years old is not going to necessarily mean it's rancid if it's been stored properly. And also, I like to buy oils that are in dark bottles as opposed to clear glass, because if they're sitting under fluorescent lights again, you're going to lose a lot of flavor.
Right, right.
And they're heading down the hill toward rancidity faster.
Downhill quickly.
Yeah.
Wonderful. Thanks for your help. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. You take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye. You know, every publication known to man seems to be doing a story on Portland, Oregon. You know, there's lots of restaurants and art and shops. But I think they've overlooked something that could be very interesting and might save us a ton of money. When we were in Portland a while back, we got wind of the oil wars and the guerrilla movement behind those wars. Now, one of the insiders is Ben Davis of Grand Central Bakery. Ben, welcome.
Oh, well, thanks for having me.
Well, Ben, what is an oil war?
Well, the big oil war isn't on our turf, but the local oil war here in Portland is a heated competition of going over used restaurant oil that the restaurants use in deep fryers. Believe it or not, this country uses 3 billion gallons of used restaurant oil a year.
How do we use it?
Well, a lot of it, I hear, goes for the animal food industry, and some of it gets shipped overseas for the cosmetic industry in Asia. Believe it or not.
So are you saying you guys have guerrilla warfare going on? You're swiping oil and you're shipping it and making money on it?
Well, what we're doing, let's back up a little. The whole gist of this is diesel engines were designed to run on peanut oil and various other oils by this guy named Rudolf Diesel, the turn of the century.
Uh-huh.
And the Standard Oil Company invented diesel and named it after his name to burn in his engine. His engines were originally running on vegetable oil. And the oil industry created diesel to run in this because they're very reliable. They have no spark ignition. There's no electronics. They're great. It was mainly military, applications for the diesel engine. Well, it's 100 years goes by and the price of oil starts going up and people start remembering that this was all sort of shoved in the closet by the oil industries, and diesel engines run wonderfully well on pure vegetable oil and biodiesel. And there's a difference between biodiesel and vegetable oil running of a car. My car runs on SVO, straight vegetable oil, which
so
all you got to do.
So you're running your car. Okay.
I run my own personal car on it.
Uh-huh.
And I did the conversion myself, and it's just a matter of heating the oil to 160 degrees, and then you have a solenoid switch on your dash, and you switch it over. So you start it on diesel or biodiesel, run it for 3 to 4 minutes, switch it over. And you're off and running, and it runs fantastic on straight vegetable oil, same gas mileage.
How long have you been doing this?
I've got about 6 months on mine, so I've got about 5,000 miles on vegetable oil.
So how do the oil wars figure into this? Is there like a competition for
the oil? Well, what's happened is there's been a little competition. Restaurants around the country pay to get their used oil fry grease disposed of, just like you pay to get your garbage taken care of at your house.
Right.
And typically, I've heard it's somewhere in the range of 20 to 25 cents a gallon to dispose of a restaurant's vegetable oil. So the guys that I know are going around town and saying, hey, I'll put my 55-gallon drum next to your tank here, and why don't you put your oil in my drum, and I'll take it away for free. And then they filter it, and, this guy he collects about 1,000 to 1,500 gallons a month right now in Portland. That is my source, and he delivers it to my house all filtered, and I have a little gravity feed tank in my garage that I fill my car with.
Huh.
So as this is heated up, and people starting to hear about that cars will actually run on straight vegetable oil, there's been a little more competition now. I think the main oil company that has the contracts with these restaurants, and they have big fancy dumpsters out there, and, they're out there getting all their customers to redo their legal documents and contracts. and you know, and saying, "Who's this other tin here?" And so everybody's kind of flexing their muscles right now in the last couple months.
So when do you think this is going to Washington and to Detroit?
Well, on the flip side of the matter, it is kind of, you know, it's interesting that it's kind of humorous that people are fighting over this used restaurant oil, okay? But 3 billion gallons a year is nothing to sneeze at. And, you know, we're just starting to actually, you know, Portland's a little ahead of the curve on this. But nationwide, there's a real fuel source out there. Not to mention what could happen with the ground that we pay farmers fallow land, you know? Mm-hmm. We pay farmers not to grow food in this country, to keep prices where they need to be. If you took that land and you planted rapeseed oil for canola,
right,
we could power 25% of our diesel needs in this country. Plain and simple, according to a study done by University of Idaho.
Huh.
So it's a really exciting, you know, grassroots generated thing. But it is. It's funny. You know, you say, I'm getting my oil from used restaurant fry grease.
And soon there'll be status. Mine comes from a 3-star restaurant. Well, mine comes from McD's. But
exactly. Anyway, mine smells like calamari. Oh, you know, mine smells like chicken wings.
Hey, Ben, thank you.
You're welcome. Anytime.
Ben Davis owns the Grand Central Bakery in Portland, Oregon. Well, that's the show for this week, guys. Thanks for joining us. And remember, you can call us anytime. The number's 800-537-5252. And until next week, let me leave you with this thought from 18th century novelist Henry Fielding. He said, and I quote, "Love and scandal are the best sweeteners of tea." The Splendid Table is produced by American Public Media and brought to you by SuperTarget. The Splendid Table is supported by the Muir Glen Organic Soup Collection. Gourmet recipe soups made from premium garden fresh ingredients. You can learn more at muirglen.com. Muir Glen Organic Soups, created to savor. Information about the things you heard here today can be found on our website, splendidtable.org. And be sure to sign up for our free e-newsletter, Weeknight Kitchen. And don't miss our weekly podcast. You can relive this moment again and again. Find it all, you know where, splendidtable.org. Our program is produced by Sally Swift and Jennifer Russell, with intern help from Alexis Donath. Our technical director is Jennifer Lubke. Our website is managed by Judy Graham and Jeff Harkness. Be sure to join us next week, and thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper.
American Public Media.